Services. You know the nerve of this oxygen gone.
You never
heard of this.
Moving out from the forest fire, moving out the elements. You know my secret intelligence, like the elephant. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Information is more concealed. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Papers get printed. Trees may be extinct, like the elephant. Like the elephant. You know the advancement for the elegance. Jones Industrial, real like my reels. You know the environmental change and its appeal. Information is more concealed. Information is more concealed. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Scientific study, action chemical buddy. McGillicuddy, dispatching out to you. Imagine. Using material for Christmas, I doubt you. Back to the lab. Oxygen coming in. Carbon dioxide coming out to you. Carbon dioxide coming out to you. Carbon dioxide coming out to you. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Information is more concealed. Trees are dying. Trees are dying. Use the material for Christmas. Papers get printed. Trees may be extinct like the elephants. You know the advancement for the elegance. Dow Jones Industrial, real like my reels. You know the environmental change and its appeal. Information is more concealed. Trees are dying. Carbon dioxide coming out to you. 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 Where you get that bench and table from? Add to the mortgage of one. You made a deficit evilly to boost your sum. Cutting trees down all around to make you king of the mighty dollar. Increase your crown. Selling boxes for Fort Knox to challenge your wooden stocks. Breaking into bolted areas with locks. The trees are dying.
Pesticides, control damage of trees and the roots. A bunch of chemicals, y'all turning it loose. A bunch of chemicals, y'all turning it loose.
This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Trudy. Stephen Trudy will be joining us soon. He has a Zoom meeting. Today we're going to be talking with Wolfie Rugel, who is currently Butte County Resource Conservation District's Forest Health Watershed Coordinator. We'll be talking with her about fires, how they happen, and what we can do to alleviate fire pressure. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the corona-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets. With year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We're going to take a little break. We're going to call Wolfie Rugel, and we'll learn about forest planning, prescribed burns, and how to create a healthy country and county.
Sit and sing.
My sack was rich and I was strong. From seed to tree, I grew so tall. Through wind and rain, I could not fall. But now my branches suffer, and my leaves don't offer poetry to men of song. Trees like me weren't meant to live, if
us now on the phone is Wolfie Rugel. Wolfie currently serves as the Butte County Resource Conservation District as a Forest Health Watershed Coordinator under a grant from the Department of Conservation. Her projects include developing the Butte Forest Plan, helping local land owners put good fire on the ground through a prescribed burning association, and writing grants to develop the next wave of watershed health projects in the county. So welcome, Wolfie.
Thanks, Susan.
It's great to have you here again.
Great to be back. Yeah.
We're going to talk a lot about fire today, but let's begin by talking a little bit about the Butte County Resource Conservation District. What is it and what is its mission?
Sure. Well, the mission of the Butte County Resource Conservation District is to protect, enhance, and support the natural resources and agriculture of Butte County by working with citizens and willing landowners through education, land management, and on-the-ground projects. So we're not actually part of county government per se. We are a special district, just like a mosquito district or a school district or an irrigation district. We perform a service for people within a certain geographic area. In our case, it's unincorporated Butte County. But we don't get any county funds or taxpayer dollars, unlike maybe a mosquito control district, to use that analogy. So we're totally funded by grants and contracts.
So do you do cooperative efforts with the county and with other agencies?
Sure. Yeah. Like right now, for instance, we're helping Butte County Public Works repair some roads and do post-fire erosion control assessments in the North Complex, burn scar, things like that. We work with the county a lot and with all kinds of other entities around here, from the city of Chico to the Butte County Fire Safe Council, just local landowners. We help a lot with forest restoration, especially after fire, which I'm sure is something we'll talk about later.
Yeah. And you are currently, has this always been your title? Because I seem to remember a different one, but maybe I just haven't been paying attention. So your current title is Forest Health Watershed Coordinator. What does that mean? And what are your responsibilities in that role?
Well, positions are funded by the Department of Conservation. The state of California funded 8 of these around the state, and the Butte RCD wrote a grant and got one of them. So this is a position that I share with another staff member at the Butte RCD, my colleague Thad Walker. And so each Forest Health Watershed Coordinator's position is slightly different, but ours here in Butte County involves a lot of grant writing to address forest watershed conditions and also erosion control, that which was a concern, especially after kind of putting grants, to provide assistance to local landowners who want to learn more about good fire through a prescribed burn association, and to engage in countywide watershed and forest health planning, which is something that we work really closely with the Butte County Fire Safe Council on.
So does your job change, I mean, from event to event, like the fires that are currently, that we're maybe getting through for the moment, do your responsibilities change after these fires or during these fires?
Well, they may, yeah. We'll see what is asked of the RCD and how we can best help after this round of fires. After the campfire, we found that the way we could help the most is we helped a bit with erosion control on the ground over the course of the winter, and then we kind of focused toward on reforestation, understanding what types of reforestation are best for local landowners, what people want the most, and what kind of reforestation will be the most climate resilient and fire resilient in the future, so we just don't just recreate the problem that we had before. And we learned a lot through that process, definitely still learning. And I wouldn't be surprised if we take a lot of those lessons that we learn and a lot of that kind of restoration framework that we built together with the Forest Service and the Fire Safe Council and nonprofits like American Forests and the National Forest Foundation, the American Forest Foundation and other groups, and end up applying that in the North Complex Burning Star, because ecologically it's not too different and it faces a lot of the same problems.
Right. I remember last year you were involved in doing prescribed burnings. That was kind of one of the big projects you were involved in. Was that something that will be continuing in the future, I assume?
Yeah, definitely. So what with COVID and everything else, we haven't gotten to put very much fire on the ground at all. Mm-hmm. But we did help some folks with burn piles, and I send out a newsletter every month and try to get people in touch with training and webinar opportunities and keep them up to date with the development of good fire policy and news, and remind people what they can do on their property to keep preparing for good fire when it becomes possible to put it on the ground
right.
again. I'm hopeful that this fall some people will want to get together for kind of socially distanced work parties and stuff. And,
right.
We've all had enough smoke, but
it might require a little
fire
more.
Fire emits about 20% of the smoke of a severe wildfire, and we know that if we can have the smoke now at a time, I mean, we can have the smoke at a time of our choosing, or we can have it at the worst possible time. So it's kind of
let's talk,
a lot to choose
yeah,
from.
Right. let's talk a little bit more about the Bear Fire and the North Complex Fire. You were quoted in the Enterprise Record a couple of weeks ago saying, quote, "When a fire is driven by high winds in extreme conditions like the Bear Fire was on September 8th and 9th, whether that land has had a prescribed burn or not probably will make very little difference." You argued that, quote, "In extreme conditions, the fire is no longer spreading from tree to tree by flame contact, so it barely matters how close together the trees are. Rather, the fire is spotting, throwing wind-borne embers miles ahead of itself."
Mm-hmm.
So were you saying that the Bear Fire and the / North Complex Fire was inevitable?
No, the severity of it wasn't inevitable, but when we look at the wind-driven fires that have happened in places like Napa and Sonoma, I mean, it's a sad truth that some of those places where people were losing homes and parts of their community actually looked like really nice and fire safe. They were just grassland, you know?
Yeah.
They weren't really overstocked conifer forest. Now, when something like the Bear Fire on September 9th is going on, I mean, I hate to say this, but if a person had, you know, if an individual landowner had burned 1 or 10 or 100 acres around her home, I mean, it might not have made a difference in an ember storm. It might have saved a few homes. If we'd been doing large-scale prescribed burning and we had a really, really healthy forest going into climate change instead of the forest that we have, then these fires would probably be a little less severe, but they'd probably still be pretty severe during weather events like we've been having. All right. So I don't want to say that prescribed burning by itself is the solution to everything, but had, you know, the entire, 300,000 acres that the North Complex ultimately burned been in really healthy condition with widely spaced trees that were really big and had already survived many, many fires, then instead of being in a fire suppressed condition, then if that were true, the North Complex would probably not have been as severe as we saw.
So you've already sort of talked about this, but I'd like you to kind of maybe tease out a little bit more. Can you describe the various factors that make us so susceptible to the kinds of fires we've gotten over the past several years? I mean, you've touched on all of these, but maybe you could kind of march us through the things that have made those fires so enormous and so destructive.
Sure. So, about the time of the gold rush, when immigrants first started coming to California and saw these amazing timber resources, these amazing huge forests that had been nurtured with centuries of regular cultural fire by the indigenous folks who lived here, they started harvesting those trees, and they went for the biggest ones first, which is logical in a way, but those big trees were the very most fire-resistant of all.
Mm.
They were almost impossible to kill with fire, I would imagine. And so after those big trees had been removed, the forest was sort of starting over from scratch. And that kind of coincided with the start of the era of fire suppression. So some of those forests came up in an age when, you know, there might not really be a fire for 10 or 20 or 40 or 100 years. Wow. There are definitely places in Butte County that haven't burned in 100 years, which is very unnatural for our forest. And when that happens, of course, the forest is very overgrown and dense. You can't see through it. You know, you can barely hear, you can barely see a few feet away. And also the duff and the dead litter and the stuff on the ground gets really, really deep, because in our dry forests, when a tree falls over and hits the ground, it stays there mm-hmm. until it burns. It doesn't just rot, as we know. So we have fuel overloading due to fire suppression. And it's very difficult to thin out those forests once they reach a point of density where it's very dangerous to burn them, and it's not always economical to thin them. So I do think that in addition to prescribed fire, I think that selective logging and a bunch of other tools too can often be a good way to get our forests back into health. But it definitely seems like what we're doing now isn't always working, although you hear some hopeful success stories from across California of people trying different things, don't you?
So clear cutting, what impact does clear cutting have on fires? On creating fires or exacerbating fires or stopping fires?
You know, it's a really good question, and I'm not exactly an expert on this, but what I've seen is that clear cuts usually leave behind a lot of slash. So while they may look, especially from the air, like areas where there's no fuel, there's actually pretty dense fuel on the ground, because as we were talking about, when limbs or bark or trees fall to the ground, they stay there in mm-hmm. California. And, you know, nobody knows that better than timber operators, and they used to burn that slash to prepare for reforestation. But because of liability laws and some other factors, it got harder and harder for them to burn off that flesh. And I think it's not very frequently done anymore. But I think that a lot of people at SDI and other timber companies would really like to incorporate fire more into silviculture. And they're looking for ways to do that. There's definitely some really smart foresters who work for those companies. Aside from that, the patchwork of clear cuts that we see in the Sierras, it looks, you know, intuitively, it looks to me like it would really slow down a fire. You see it from the air, and there's like patches of trees, and then there's open patches. And you'd think, well, the fire's going to lay down when it hits that open patch, right? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's going to break up the spread of the fire, but that doesn't seem to be what happens. It's almost like those patches of ground that don't have trees, maybe they heat up a lot faster, or they dry out, and they dry out the surrounding forest, and they kind of have a wicking effect, maybe mm-hmm. making the forest drier than it otherwise would be. I haven't seen studies on this, and I'm not really sure. And if anybody has information about that, to educate me, I'm very open to it because I'm not a forester.
Mm-hmm. So selective, you just said something that surprised me, I guess, that a lot of the forestry companies have good foresters who can give good advice when forests when they're taking out trees. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. And I think in particular, most foresters, certainly everyone I've ever spoken to who works for SDI, which is the company where I know the most folks, everyone I've ever spoken to who works there is smart. They know that forests need fire to be healthy. And I think that a lot of them would really like to be able to integrate fire into forestry more. From what I've seen and from conversations that I've had, I think that they would love to be able to do that. But I think that they need social permission to do that. They need some liability reform here in our state to be able to do that. And I think we'll get there.
But it's gonna take policy. Is this governmental action that needs
yes.
to?
Yes, I think it's going to take state-level liability policy change. And I think we'll see that before too long. I mean, it's heartbreaking to see SPI lose all of these hundreds of thousands of acres of timberland. I don't like to see people lose, you know, all this livelihood and jobs and stuff. And it's nobody wanted for this to happen, least of all SPI. So I'm hoping that there's a new era of pyrosilviculture ahead where good fire and timber are better integrated, and it might look completely different from what we see now. I don't know what it'll look like, but I'm excited about it.
Hi, Wolfie. Steve here, joining the conversation late. I just wanted to make an observation. It's obviously in the best interest of the forestry industry to be able to regrow those patches, and I know outfits think 60, 80 years ahead. So what you're saying about their interest in preserving the forest and having safe forest maintenance makes great sense to me.
Great. Yeah.
So let's take a short break here. I want to hear a little bit more about the cultural practices that you have referred to of Native peoples and about how that worked to contribute to the health of the forest. So we'll come back and talk about that in just a second.
Save the planet for another day.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Our guest tonight is Wolfie Rugel. She is the Forest Health Watershed Coordinator for the Butte County Resources Conservation District. Her MA thesis from Chico State explored prescribed fire policy on private lands. Wolfie, I'd like to ask you, you've talked a little bit about the cultural practices of Native peoples as contributing to the health of the forest, preventing big fires. Could you please tell us a little more about that? Specifically, what were some of those practices? What kinds of areas did they cover? And how were they controlled?
Sure. I'd love to talk about that. So I'm not an expert in Native cultural burning, and there's plenty that I don't know, but one thing that I've noticed a lot from talking to Native folks and reading about their efforts to bring good fire back to their territories and restore their cultural traditions is that for the dominant culture nowadays, prescribed fire is really all about reducing fuels. You burn when it's a good season and you can have control of the fire and you don't put up too much smoke, then you'll get less fire, less smoke out of in the bad, tough season when you don't want it. And that's a very reasonable goal, but when Native folks burned, and when they still burn now, they weren't just trying to reduce fuels. They had hundreds and hundreds of objectives, and each tribe's burn was a little bit different because each ecosystem was a little different. But they weren't just trying to avert a catastrophe. They were trying to build the world that they wanted to have. They wanted more of the food and habitat and basketry resources and plants and animals that were really important to them and that they saw as essential for a good life. And fire was how they developed that beautiful homeland and kept it thriving and abundant. So fire wasn't just sort of needed maintenance. It was really part of their covenant with life itself. And I think that that's something that we can all learn from. And I think, too, that even though, you know, I don't have indigenous roots here in California, and I know I'll probably never fully understand the richness of indigenous cultural traditions like a Native person would, no matter where you came from, no matter where your ancestors, originally were from, at some point, you're descended from someone who had a good relationship. There is almost no culture in the world that doesn't have some kind of fire land management tradition. I'm sure there are some, or in certain eras there have been some, but, fire is just kind of what makes us human, and fire is how we fulfill that human responsibility of caring for the land.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. I like that. I like the way you talk about it. We talked a little bit about fire suppression earlier, but again, we'd like to go a little bit deeper with that. When it began, who started it? What were their goals in fire suppression? Obviously, they were trying to keep things from burning, but you know, what were they thinking? How did the ideas and theories about, and when did these ideas and theories about fire suppression change? And are there still people, this is a whole lot of questions.
That's a big question.
But are there still people who think we should be doing that?
Yeah, there probably are some. I think that fire suppression really started in the early 1900s after some really severe fires, especially in the Rocky Mountain states. That it's my understanding had caught and propagated in areas that had been recently logged and had a lot of slash lying around. Mm. These were, I mean, we think we have bad fires now, but these fires killed many, many, many people. Mm. And were really terrible. And they also, of course, wiped out a lot of forests, like the mega fires we're seeing now. And so foresters in particular were influenced at that time by German forestry science. Germany is one of the few places on Earth, Germany where my ancestors are from, that doesn't really have much of a fire-based land management tradition. It's not a fire-adapted ecosystem most of Germany isn't. If you go to France, Portugal, Spain, Greece, Italy, even Scandinavia, even the British Isles, you'll find, I think, probably more people managing the land with fire. But anyway, but Germany is a really great place to grow trees. Mm-hmm. Really great place to grow nice, tall, straight pine trees. And that was a really important resource for folks who were building what we know as California today, here in the beginning of the 20th century. And they felt like, you know, timber is just this really important national resource, and we really shouldn't allow it to be burned up. Ranchers, on the other hand, were kind of cool with burning. They realized that burning kept the forests open so they could have their animals there, and they were fine with it. But foresters felt like trees are just too important to lose so many to fire. And look, we could just be growing so many more trees here. Why don't we just do it? And I'm sure they meant well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they managed to suppress fires very successfully for a very long time, and we know the rest of the story. And I'm afraid I've forgotten the rest of your question.
So they suppressed it. So when did people and then massive fires followed? And so how have the theories about how we manage fire change? And I know this might not be exactly to your expertise, mm-hmm. but how... there probably was a time with competing theories. How have the theories changed? That was basically
sure.
the question.
Well, you know, it's important to say that there were some people who were saying all along that you shouldn't suppress fire, and that fire is something the land needs, largely native voices and a bunch of ranchers. Harold Biswell, who I think was writing as early as the 60s, was a University of California at Berkeley forestry professor who was kind of the first notable academic to really commit to the thesis that actually California's forests, most of them, really need fire. He famously said that fire in California is as important as rain. And he waged a thankless and kind of martyr-like struggle against the forestry conventional wisdom of the day until gradually his view of things kind of became conventional wisdom. And by the time I was going to the University of California at Davis back in the very early 2000s, you know, the notion that California needs fire to be healthy was universally accepted.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, I learned in my classes that we were going to use prescribed fire everywhere, and people were already doing it up and down the Sierras, and this is just how we're going to operate from now on. And I kind of thought that's what was happening. I went off on my own. I kind of did this farming thing. I was sort of like not really paying attention to the news or anything. And I assumed that, you know, forest managers were lighting off millions of acres of good fire in the Sierra Nevada. And the coast ranges, and, you know, across California every year. Come to find out, imagine my surprise when I found out that in some years it was like tens of thousands of acres.
Oh, wow.
And that's not for want of information, and it's certainly not for want of passion or dedication on the part of forest managers. But for a long time we've had incentives and liability structures that are not really aligned with our policy about what we know we need forests, what we know forests need to be healthy. So we've been telling everybody, hey, light prescribed fires, it's the way to go. But at the same time, we have been holding them responsible for the consequences if a single prescribed fire ever gets out of hand.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And, you know, generally when we think that something is in the public good and we want more of it, we generally structure liability around that activity so that when there inevitably is, you know, even if it's very rare, a mistake or some damage or destruction that's associated with that generally good activity, we don't let that ruin people's lives, careers, or companies.
When you suggest, and I know that you've worked on this in the past, to farmers or to people that you've worked with in Butte County, how do you create prescribe fires? How do you get people on board with it? And then how are they conducted?
So I'm also, one of the many things in which I am not an expert is implementing prescribed fire. I've had a few like super small fires on my property in Tehama County, and I've been present when a few other people who are experienced burners are putting fire on the ground. But you know, I'm not out there to persuade anybody that prescribed fire is what their land needs. But there's a lot of people in the county who are just like really hungry for that land management knowledge, because who wouldn't want to leave their land in better condition than they found it? And most of us didn't grow up with any kind of fire tradition.
Right.
Maybe some folks did if you come from a ranching family or a native tradition, but most of us, you know, nobody ever took us out when we were 8 years old and showed us how fire creeps up a slope. So people really want to understand this because they want to understand the place that they live. That's natural. So my role in coordinating the Prescribed Burn Association is to listen to people, understand what they want, try to connect them with each other, try to maybe provide a place where they can borrow tools, they can connect with each other, they can kind of get a crew of volunteers together to do burn prep or hopefully even burning soon on their land once they've decided that it's the right choice for them and that they do have a unit that they can burn safely and that they have all the permits and everything that they need in place. I'm just here to be a support so that people can build community-based prescribed burn capacity.
I see. And then who are the experts that make that happen?
Well, most prescribed fire on private lands, if it's not led by CAL FIRE, which it can be, then it's just led by the landowner himself. I mean, you have the right to burn your land, mm-hmm. either with a permit in fire season or without a permit between the end of declared fire season and May 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a skill that you can develop over time, and you can learn how to go out there and put fire on the ground safely.
Did you have a question?
You can also pay somebody to do it. I mean, there are contractors who will come and with their crews and put prescribed fire on your ground. It's pretty expensive,
yeah.
But you could totally go that route.
I wanted to ask about Trump's rakes and slash a little bit. My experience making slash is a lot of fun. Lopping off limbs, whacking down bushes. Hauling it out is not. And in my observation up in the Sierra, I see a lot of slash that's been left over that the timber companies just didn't want to remove. On a bicycle trip through Germany, this is strictly anecdotal, I and my son were amazed at mile after mile of German forest that was immaculate. I was told that people pick up the slash, burn it for home heating and so forth, but the forests were pretty immaculate. And I wonder if the alternative, as some people have talked about, cleaning up the forest, physically removing that slash, maybe turning it into biochar or getting it somewhere else, is that even remotely possible given the size of our forests?
Well, I mean, anything's possible. We could certainly do that. And sometimes, I mean, there are forests that are probably so far out of their bioreturn interval that they're not safely burnable before some work is done to them. So a lot of times in the process of restoring good fire to a forest often starts with doing some hand thinning or mechanical thinning and dragging some of that biomass out of the forest just so you can safely burn it in a little bit of a wider window sometime in the year. It would be great, you know, just to have more folks working in the woods. There's a lot of woods out there. There's a lot of people who could use a job. And, it would be great to get people out there cleaning up the forests. I can think of plenty of places where that needs to happen. But there's just no money to do that.
Yeah,
most of the time. Prescribed fire can be very cost effective in the right situation. Again, it's not necessarily right for every single unit everywhere.
We learned also in the Enterprise Record article that the Resource Conservation District was recommended for funding from two California Forest Health grants totaling $1.6 million. Can you tell us about those grants and what they're meant to do and how you'll be involved with that?
Sure. So, yeah, these are grants pertaining to forest health. They're not part of CAL FIRE's CCI forest health program, but they're part of the Wildlife Conservation Board's forest conservation program. And so these are two planning grants for two different spots in Butte County. One of them, the larger one, is $1.4 million to help the Almanor Ranger District of the Lassen National Forest up around Butte Meadows and Jonesville to conduct NEPA on almost 17,000 acres of federal land all around Jonesville. And I'm really excited about that because being able to do that NEPA on a large scale and to plan for the reintroduction of prescribed fire up there, you know, so that's an area of Butte County where a lot of it has not burned in 100 years. It would be amazing to be part of restoring fire up there. And then it's the headwaters of Butte Creek, which is one of the most important spring run Chinook salmon streams in California. And it's a really cool place. It's a southernmost refugium for a lot of species that have their strongholds more up north, like the Cascade Frog. There's goshawks and spotted owls there. And
oh, nice.
There's a lot of fens and wetlands and cool springs and meadows. And it's just a really, really special place up there. So that's the larger of the two grants. The other one is a smaller grant, a little under $200,000. And this is planned for the Concal Flea Valley area, close to where the campfire started.
Mm-hmm.
For a while now, CAL FIRE has been talking about the idea of doing regular maintenance prescribed fire pods in that area. They don't have, as far as I know, they don't have, you know, firm plans to do that anytime soon, but they have been talking about developing those plans along with SPI, again, and the Forest Service in that area to kind of create some patches or... I keep calling them pods.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what a pod was and how big it is.
It's just like a shape. It's like...
Yeah.
It's like a blob. It's a blob that aligns with...
So how big would a pod be?
...slope and ridgetop in the right way. And Concal is a place... A lot of Butte County is a place where after high-severity fire, brush regrows very, very quickly. And there's a lot of that project area where if you go out now, it hasn't even been 2 years after the campfire, but... it's pretty tough to get across some of those hillsides and canyons now. And the idea is that regular prescribed fire, not across that whole area, but in, again, in little blobs, might really not only help help that community be better defensible, but also might really help with habitat. Because when there's a big patch of habitat that all burned at the same moment and all regrew at the same moment, it's just pretty homogeneous. And that's not as good habitat as when there's pyrodiversity. So a lot of different fires burning at different times, different seasons, different intensities, creating a patchwork mosaic of different kinds of habitat. That's what we'd really like to see for the deer, for the birds and the pollinators and everybody, and for the people too. And I think that's why the Wildlife Conservation Board funded that grant.
Please go ahead.
Another thing that I'm excited about with that grant is that this prescribed fire would be cross-boundary. So it would be the federal land managers collaborating with Sierra Pacific Industries that has a lot of land in Concal. It's like a patchwork. It's a checkerboard there. And then CAL FIRE would be helping out and assuming the liability that would otherwise fall on Sierra Pacific Industries. So this would be a great opportunity for SPI to put some good fire on the ground in collaboration with CAL FIRE and the U.S. Forest Service. And SPI wrote a letter of support for this grant, as did CAL FIRE and the Forest Service. So I'm really excited to kick this process off.
And so what are the next steps for this? What will you be doing, like, first, second, third?
Well, you mean for this Concal grant?
Yeah, for the... Well, yeah, for the Concal.
The next step is to, after the fire stops burning...
Yes.
And
we're almost there.
We can actually, talk to each other again. The next step is for CAL FIRE and vegetation managers at SPI and fuels managers at the Forest Service to sit down and continue the work that they've already started, sitting down around a map and figuring out where the most strategic places to put good fire on the ground would be. And then once those experts figure that out, They can hand us a map, and the RCD will go to work completing the CEQA and NEPA, which are the environmental review processes that need to happen before implementation can happen. We'll do all the surveys, we'll file the documents, we'll, you know, deal with the comment periods and all of that stuff, and we'll get it in good shape so that they can do their work.
So about how long does that process take to get that all through? I know that sometimes CEQA can be
slow. Just the CEQA and NEPA is probably going to take 9 months to a year.
Right. Right.
It depends on how fast the plans come together and whether the areas that the fuels managers find strategic happen to already have had a lot of surveys, which will make us very happy, or if they all need to be surveyed for the first time, which will also make us very happy because we'll get to get out there and get a lot of blackberry scratches on our legs.
Yeah, that'll be fun. What can you tell us about the National Prescribed Fire Act of 2020? Is that new? I mean, it's 2020, so.
It is fairly new. I think I just heard about it for the first time maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, if that. You know, it's a pretty remarkable bill. Now, I'm not supposed to take a position on legislation, I don't think. But this bill would set aside specialized, you know, reserved funding for prescribed fire for both the Forest Service and the Department of the Interior, which manages BLM land. And importantly, instead of just throwing money at training and implementation, it actually kind of reforms the system of incentives so that federal land managers, at least, have more of an incentive to light prescribed fires than to not light them. You know, when they're making that decision, when the conditions are right and the prescription is there and you're ready to go, I think that this bill is really designed to just kind of tilt people's cost-benefit calculation a little bit so that you're not thinking, well, I could light this fire and hopefully it'll go well, but if it doesn't go well, I'll lose my job and my career. But if it does go well, I won't really get anything, right?
Right,
And so I think that this bill was designed to restructure things so that if the fire does go well, you do get something. There are incentives. And if the fire doesn't go well, which, you know, not that many prescribed fires escape or cause any problems. We hear a lot about them when they do, but it's less than 1%.
Oh, wow.
And most of those don't actually cause injuries or structure damage. Mm. Some of them cause more suppression costs than we anticipated. Of course, there's exceptions. But, you know, if something does go wrong, then it's not necessarily the end of the career for that person who made that decision. Mm-hmm. You need to look at the quality of the decision and not necessarily the outcome. Because, you know, in a chaotic situation, in a stochastic situation where weather and fuels and all kinds of unpredictable factors are coming into play, what we need is people who made the right decision based on the information that they had at the time. And based on the federal land managers that I've known, these are extremely conscientious and smart people. And I'm very excited that they may get the tools to put more fire on the ground.
Nice.
Whether it's through the National Prescribed Fire Act of 2020 or some other way, that was very neutral.
I hear you being neutral.
You're also engaged in reforesting efforts. Could you tell us a little bit about those and their value?
Sure. Yeah, so I think the first thing I want to say is that not every acre that burns needs to be reforested. And not every acre that burns needs to be reforested with the species or at the density that was there before. Definitely after the campfire, we followed what is now considered the best practice of waiting at least a year to really make reforestation decisions or help landowners with their reforestation decisions. And we planted some trees this spring, but you know, even now we've returned to the sites where we planted some trees early in the spring, and it's amazing how much the natural vegetation has come back even since a year after the fire. You see oaks resprouting and just being incredibly vigorous. And
oh, good.
You see very little conifer regeneration in the campfire scar. where it burned at high severity, there's just no seed left in a lot of places. But you do see an oak woodland coming
That's
back.
That's great.
And when we talk to folks, we hear a lot of folks saying that what they want to see on their land, even if there were conifers coming up, what they want to see is really an oak woodland because they feel like it's going to be more climate resilient,
yes,
and more fire resilient.
Yes.
So
that's what we want.
There you go.
Yeah.
So in the, you know, it's almost, now there are definitely places where it's a great idea to try to nurture along some conifers. What the landowner's vision for their land is always what we respect. First and foremost, and we try to help them achieve it if we can.
Nice.
But in a way, it's kind of almost been more of a struggle to not plant trees. Or it turns out there's a whole like reforestation economy, and there's all of these nonprofits and foundations that have money for you to plant trees, and they all would really like for you to plant as many conifers as you can on an acre because they're cheap, they're economically important. We have this really great system for raising millions of conifers and putting them in the ground, and those start sequestering carbon, and you can get carbon credits for that. And, you know, that's wonderful, but it's not always the best thing for every part of California. So we have worked with a few organizations that have more of a climate-informed perspective and realize, hey, let's not do the same thing that we've been doing every place else throughout the West. Maybe here at lower elevations that are like the Butte County foothills that are seeing the impacts of climate really strongly, maybe we should transition to a different mix of species, and maybe we should plant more hardwoods and think about things a little differently, which is really nice to see.
Right, right. We were talking with a person whose name I know so well but can't remember right now, who's the head of the preservation, and I'm not coming.
It'll come to me.
Okay.
I'm thinking about
But he's talking about the need. Oh, no, I think we were talking to Richie Bramlett. Was Richie Bramlett saying we need to be looking at what kind of trees to plant that are good in climates, that our climate is going to be in the future?
So he's looking for seeds in southern New Mexico, figuring that's what we might be growing up here in the future.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay. It is, isn't it?
I mean, I think that is how land managers need to be thinking. And a land manager is what he is. He's the city forester.
Yeah.
I think we need to be trying a lot of different things. And I'm sure he hasn't just picked out southern New Mexico and he's only planting trees from there. Right?
No, he's sure doing some good research.
He realizes that we just don't know what's coming.
Right.
We have some ideas. We have some science. But we need to have the humility to try a bunch of different things and change our tactics if it's not working.
So
I respect that.
Yeah, me too. So we just have a minute here. Could you just tell people how they can learn more about Butte County Resource Conservation District's work? And if there's anything that they can do to help BCRCD's work.
Sure, I'd love to do that. So we have a website, bcrcd.org. That's the initials of Butte County Resource Conservation District. You can also follow us on Facebook, which is where we release a lot of news about our reforestation project, volunteer opportunities, educational opportunities, tours, cool stuff like that. The website is where you can join the Prescribed Burn Association. If anybody else out there is interested in learning more about Good Fire, just go to the website, bcrcd.org, and sign up through the Good Fire link. We also just started a relationship with North Valley Community Foundation, where we're going to have a special fund set up through them where people from anywhere, county or beyond, can donate specifically for reforestation efforts. Both in the Campfire SCAR and in the North Complex SCAR, and I hate to say it, but if there is a future high severity wildfire that does require reforestation in the future, then we'll be there providing reforestation that's as climate adapted and fire adapted as we can make it. So I know that fund isn't up and running yet, but in the future that's something that will be giving people the opportunity to connect with us over that.
Thank you so much, Wolfie. Wolfie Brugel is the Butte County Resource Conservation District's Forest Health Watershed Coordinator. And as you can tell, there are a lot of projects going on. So we will post their website on our website. And thanks so much for joining us, Wolfie. We appreciate your expertise.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks, Steve. Have a great night.
You too.
Coming up in just a couple minutes, Ginger Nichols will be on with Radioactive Music. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Thanks very much for listening.
Weave me the sunshine out of the falling rain. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again. Sing it with me. And the tongue.